Thank you, Chairman. It's a real pleasure to be here. I want to pose the question and maybe try and answer it a little. What can finance learn from science, from technology, from other disciplines? My short answer is going to be almost everything. That's the bad news. The good news, I think, is that some progress has been made over the last 4 or 5 years to put some of the wrongs right. I thought I might touch also on those positives from the crisis. But let me start with a very simple thought experiment, just to give you some sense of how extraordinary the events of the last 20 years or so have been. And this experiment might run as follows. Imagine we were sat here in 1900 and we placed a bet, a hedged bet. We'd gone long on bank equities and short of non-bank equities. Okay, so a hedged bet. If banks and non-banks performed roughly similarly, we'd come out square. And for around 90 years, that is exactly what happened. 90 years in, you'd have been up a bit from having been net long banking, but not very much. As you'd expect, pretty much all square. The next 20 years saw something truly extraordinary happen in the run-up to 2006, 2007. The excess returns to banking cumulatively were eye-wateringly big. We thought we had struck gold. We all know that that worked brilliantly right up to the point where it didn't. We've now seen that bet, as we'd expect, return to earth. But what a roller coaster journey that has been. Now, if that had just been a bubble that inflated and popped, we could all say, so what? But of course, we know that this hasn't just been a case of a bubble popping. The collateral damage has been enormous. Just to give some sense of the scale of that, so when we're thinking about policy reform, it's always good to have some sense of how costly has this event been, and what are the costs then of implementing remedial policy measures. Let's just take a second to scale those costs of the crisis we are still living through. This shows output, GDP, in the UK. That's the blue line. The red line is its roughly trend path. So far, the cumulative output loss from the crisis is of the order of £500 billion sterling, roughly a third of pre-crisis GDP. It's a pretty chunky number. Of course, it's not over yet. So what we did is project forward that line, that's the green line now, using IMF forecasts of future growth, which, if anything, might be a bit on the positive side, given today's number. The extra shaded area takes us up to around £2 trillion sterling, well in excess of 1 year's GDP. The IMF forecast finished in 2018, so I haven't shaded in all the area. I haven't done a full NPV calculation, but suffice to say that we're looking at a cumulative cost, even discounted, that is probably several multiples of the annual income of this country. If I were to set that cost alongside the biggest number I've seen for the cost of reform, that would be 1, 2, 3% of GDP. Okay? So the cost-benefit comparison differs by at least one, perhaps two orders of magnitude. So, the case for reform, for me at least, appears compelling. What form might that reform most usefully take? Oh, this is just a final picture. Martin Wolf at the FT is fond of saying the only thing that's more costly than crises are wars. And this just speaks to that. So the actual path is the blue and the green line. The light blue line is the Great Depression. We're roughly tracking in the UK the Great Depression, but almost certainly looking forward, the costs will be greater than in the Great Depression. And by comparison with, say, the First and Second World Wars, the output loss from this crisis is roughly around the same as the average of those two. So Martin's roughly right, about the same as a big war. What's been done? Well, the good news is that I think, albeit 1 degree at a time, the regulators, the financial professionals are going through a 180. I've listed on the left-hand side here some of the words that were used to describe the thinking, the risk models pre-crisis. And on the right-hand side, the world to which we are ever so gradually evolving, how the rhetoric, the semantics of risk are changing. You can read these for yourself. Let me pick out just one, which is the second one. So pre-crisis, the efficient market hypothesis meant all the talk was of financial prices behaving as if a random walk. These days, although the notion of levy flight is not one that comes easy to economists. So when my economist friends ask me, you know, what is this thing, levy flight, I tell the story of the bird foraging for food, that most of the time will seek out the low distance, low protein food option. It will be, generally speaking, risk averse in its behavior, except when it's struggling to find any food, at which point it seeks the high-protein, high-distance option. So this is a central banker simulating a bird here, just so you've seen it here first. In other words, the bird gambles for resurrection when facing acute risks. They say, and what relevance has that got to finance? And I say, well, those are exactly the behaviours exhibited by the CEOs of the world's biggest banks in 2007. So Dick Fuld and Lehman Brothers essentially went for the high risk, high protein, gamble for resurrection option. It was that, among other things, that brought the world to a shuddering halt. More generally, taking together the points from this is that, having thought about the financial world, the financial network, node by node, firm by firm, ever so gradually, we're moving to a system that's thought about and regulated as though, indeed, it were a system. So what were some of the defects pre-crisis that led us down the left-hand column path? And what are we doing now to remedy those defects? One of the perils, and the ones that one that John talked about just now, was the perils of estimating probabilities, the perils of using models to calibrate risks. In the 10 or 15 years pre-crisis, an enormous amount of intellectual effort, often drawn from the natural sciences, was used within financial firms to construct models, risk management models, of quite Byzantine complexity to better measure, to better calibrate risks. John showed this quote from David Vinier, which I will not repeat. The only rejoinder I'll provide is the number of how likely was it that David Vinier had indeed spotted a black swan event. It's something, assuming normality, it's a fairly unlikely event. A more likely interpretation was that David had his model not quite right. But not to beat up too much on the risk professionals, the self-same mistakes, the self-same cognitive dissonance was present within the regulator community. So when we were setting regulatory standards for banks, one source of comfort we sought was to set those standards, sort of cover off with a 99.9% probability the chance of a bank going bust, sort of provide enough insurance to cover one failure every millennium. What that equated to from our risk models was that banks should on average hold one unit of equity for every 99 units of debt. In other words, they would be 100 times leveraged. That proved to be a huge underestimate of the scale of resources banks might need, which is why many of them teetered and many fell during the course of the crisis. The good news is that as a result of regulatory reform over the last 3 or 4 years, we have gone from one unit of equity for every 99 of debt to 5 units of equity. We have quintupled the so-called capital requirements of banks. You can reach your own conclusion about whether you think that has gone sufficiently far to cover off the sort of tail risks of the Divinia and others have talked about. And indeed, these tails are really as important, if not more important, in finance as they are in the natural world. Here's just a log, a CDF of earthquakes on the left-hand side and equities on the right. The straight line is the implied distribution under normality. Under both cases, the tails are big and fat. It was these tails that David Vinia and the regulatory community got quite wrong in the run-up to 2007. And it wasn't just probabilities, it was impacts as well. Because as John said, one of the, with hindsight, peculiarities of how risk management and regulation was done pre-crisis is that it was done node by node. Risk was measured as though individual firms were islands. Here's a quote, this time not from Tim Geithner, but from his colleagues across the road at the IMF in 2006, making the point that bigger ought to be better in finance. Why was that? Because bigger meant a greater diversification of the risks that were out there. And the point that that quote misses, the point that regulators missed, was that even if, and it's a big if, the probability of failure was lower, the impact of a big node going down, a big connected node going down, was proportionately greater. And the crisis of 2007-2008 was precisely one of connectivity and size ricocheting around the world and causing those output losses that I spoke about. So pre-crisis, we convinced ourselves that bigger, more connected banks were safer and therefore could run with lower levels of insurance. This was a pretty grade one intellectual error. Had we read, say, Bob's work from the early 70s, looking at contagious spread in epidemiological networks, we'd have known that rather than these big connected super spreader entities running with less insurance, on average, we need them to run with greater insurance. Again, the qualified good news is that that insight, 40 years on, has been taken to heart by financial regulators to some degree. So over the course of the last 12 months, it's been agreed internationally, including by Tim Geithner, that the biggest, most connected firms, banks in the world, will run with bigger insurance buffers, albeit not that much bigger. So some limited progress there too. The third dimension, and really linking back to the one I've just discussed, is that, as I mentioned, pre-crisis finance itself and regulators of finance did not at all think of what they were controlling as being anything network-like. So the jigsaw pieces were looked at on an individual basis. There was little effort made to put those pieces together to get an aggregate picture of how the network looked, how resilient it might be. Whole set of reasons for why that was. A very basic one, but actually a rather important one, was that none of the data was collected in a consistent enough form to join those dots. All the risk management information was focused on the risk that firm was taking, and almost none on the links between firms, the links rather than the nodes. We had nothing like the common language that we have, for example, for the World Wide Web, which enabled it to join the dots, so to be viewed as a network. Right now, even today, we do not have at our disposal the data to join the dots, to draw the pictures. This, of course, is very standard in the natural sciences. Here's just three pictures of webs of different types from the natural sciences. The first one is a food web. We have a network of scientific collaboration down in the bottom left. And in the bottom right, a network of sexual contact between individuals in a study. I was struck this morning, looking at this, the similarity between the bottom two pictures, which I'm hoping is coincidental. Over the last year or two, we've begun to try and think about drawing pictures of this rough type for international finance. Here's a web picture for how the international financial system has evolved over the last 25 years or so. It shows a picture of an increasingly cobweb-type structure. But in general, the tools of the trade, the raw data, are not there even to begin to draw these pictures. And of course, without drawing them, it's very difficult to manage the web, the financial web, as though it were a web. We are not yet in a position where, for example, we could draw weather maps, financial weather maps, warning of incipient risks, warning of incipient cliff edges, warning of rising systemic risks. And without that map, it also makes it difficult to think about the sort of question that John raised at the end, which is, how is it we might usefully rewire this network to make it more robust? There are a handful of global initiatives that are moving in this general direction, that are seeking to move us from this dense, complex, cat's cradle of interconnections into something that's rather simpler, something that, in the words that John used, is more modular, is less complex. In the words of Charles Perrow, is less tightly coupled. In the words of Herbert Simon, is decomposable, which is therefore more resilient in the face of stress. You mentioned the cover does not bear on this. One of the initiatives that is underway internationally, kicked off by the G20 a few years ago, was to replace this dense, complex cat's cradle of interconnections with a rather more simplified hub and spokes type configuration. And these are these things called central counterparties that serve as the buyer to all sellers and the seller to all buyers. They sit there in the middle of the web and simplify it to a hub and spokes configuration. There are proposals on both sides of the Atlantic to achieve a little bit more of the modularity, the decomposability, the removal of tight coupling from banking systems. There's this proposal by Paul Volcker, former chairman of the Federal Reserve System, to annex off some of banks' riskier activities. There are proposals in this country by John Vickers to ring fence different activities that banks are undertaking. Both of these are in the spirit of John's structural reform. Both are in the spirit of achieving greater modularity in the network. It's questionable whether either goes sufficiently far to break down the dense thicket of complexity that currently envelops the financial web. Let me end with a more forward-looking thought about where finance may have gone wrong. Here's a quote from that man, Paul Volcker, again, about the use of technology in banking. You can read it for yourself. This is a critical comment. But it has, I think, more than a grain of truth. The perversity here is that the words, you know, if we are to believe this week's Economist, we are on the cusp of a third industrial revolution brought about by IT. The I in IT means information. And the market in finance is a market in information. So if one piece of technological revolution was to have most affected an industry, you would think it might be the financial industry, for whom information is the stock in trade. The facts, however, tell a somewhat different picture. Here's a an estimate, it's no more than that, because we measure these things terribly, of the unit cost of financial intermediation in the United States over the last 130 years or so. Standing aside from the wobbles up and down, the one takeaway I would give you is that that has gone up. Okay? So at least in principle, this tells a story of finance not really having fully harnessed the productivity-enhancing benefits of information technology. If anything, the unit cost of financial intermediation services might be somewhat greater than that being paid by our grandfather's grandfather. Why might that be? There's a whole set of reasons. Finance and banking is a peculiar industry because it's one in which there is almost no exit and almost no entry. So up until last year, there had not been a new bank set up in the UK for a century, which speaks to something having gone wrong about entry, about potential barriers to entry. And of the potential barriers to entry, information, or the unwillingness to disseminate information, I would count as among the more important. If we were looking for finance to harness some of the same productivity-enhancing benefits that we've seen in retail, in wholesale, one obvious route would be to break down those informational barriers, to make the information currently held in-house in banks available on an open basis. We see at the fringes of banking this beginning to happen, a non-bank market in financial services emerging. At present, this is right on the fringes. But looking forward from now, if we looked at the lessons from industries as diverse as music or publishing or job search or finding a partner, the interesting aspect of all of those industries is that IT has truly revolutionized them, and the way it's revolutionized them is to extract the middleman. Banking is the ultimate middleman. It's a middleman in information. It's an information problem that IT, if anything, can resolve. And that, if anything, might offer some hope for the future of us not ending up down the path that we've been over the last 3 or 4 years. Let me stop there. Thank you.